wave which is TMS, transfer magnetic mode, is trapped in that interface, and it follows the curvature of the Earth. And that's the whole story. So when near field is ended, and they did with 52 megahertz, now they're trying to do with 17 kilohertz. Now, when the near field is ended, then the far field doesn't exist. It doesn't radiate. Enter it here.
Okay, as you can tell, I'm very skeptical that this is going to work. Very desirable sounding to transmit electric power with no wires. With careful focusing of microwave signals, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in Goldstone, California, they did do an experiment of transmitting a 2.3 gigahertz signal across a 1 mile or a 3 mile path, and very difficult. To transmit signals to all possible locations on the Earth, because you think you're lighting up the ionosphere just the right way and making a mirror image of the ground, I don't think Mother Nature's going to let you do that. And by the way, if you did have the ability to transmit radio signals, electric power, between point A and point B, what's magic about point B that makes it the only place where it's going to be picked up? It's going to be picked up by thousands of other places that are not connected to your equipment. An awful lot of that power is going to be wasted. So the efficiency of the system you're describing can't be anything that's useful, if you know what I mean. ODUS, K2R, I know you and I have a strong difference of opinion on this one. So I guess in about 4 or 5 weeks, we'll find out how the experiment worked out. And I'm predicting it's not going to be very favorable if they're telling us the truth. N2XJN, K2IW.
Repeat to GXM, comment.
Yeah, over to you, Rich, first. GXM, go ahead.
Okay.
2XJN, K2RW in the group. This is WB2GXM, Rich. I have a concern, continuing concern about interference with these. It seems the world is moving forward without regard to people who rely on older systems. We listen to HF propagation, we listen to VHF. We need to hear things, and the world is moving in a direction where it seems to be interfering with our ability to receive radio signals with, you know, broadband transmission. Now, I respect Tesla. I think Tesla is a genius. But I'm concerned. Is radio going to become obsolete because the world doesn't care about it? WB2GXM.
The modern day techniques are becoming more and more digital, and if you don't have the right kind of a digital receiver, you don't get the demodulated signal. But the basic transmission is still analog RF. Inside of those digital pulses of transmission, the real radio signal is still there. You can't eliminate that. That's the only way signals go through the air that I know of, is electromagnetic radiation, whether it be high frequency like light or low frequency like radio or and so on. So the fact that we're moving more digital means that unless you're willing to keep up with the state of the art and you have to buy a DRSM radio and a D-Star radio and so on, you're not going to be getting the signal. That's what I think you're suggesting, you know, Rich. WB2GXM, K2RIW.
Yes, correctly. I'm concerned about this. And I see this now in consumer electronics. They have a car which has a flat spot. You can put your cell phone or whatever on there and it will charge it. I don't want that. I don't want that car. If I'm carrying older technology in the form of cassettes or anything else with precious magnetic media on it, I don't want it getting anywhere near that surface. WB2GXM.
You don't want to buy that car with the spot that can charge your cell phone by holding it near that. Are you afraid of radio frequency biohazard affecting you as a driver inside of that car? Is that what your concern is, Rich?
Not at all. I know that there is no hazard from so-called radiation. But there is a hazard if I am carrying older technology. I still use cassettes I still use VHS tapes. If I happen to bring one of those things near that surface, that older treasured media is history. What about the old? People don't care about this stuff anymore. You know, they don't listen. I didn't want the iPad because it has magnets all around the front. I don't want to bring that thing near something that it may erase. And it's the same thing with electricity through the air. It's going to interfere with what I want to enjoy in the terms of amateur radio, WB2GXM.
When it comes to getting your magnetic tapes and their discs erased because you put them near strong magnetic fields, I understand that danger. What is your fear now about radio signals going through the air of the old-fashioned techniques like AM radio on 3800 kilohertz? What makes you think you're not going to be able to receive those in the future, Rich Grad?
Well, the progressive technology, this experiment with transmitting electricity through the air, I can only hear that interfering with what we define as radio. And I see that most of the world doesn't really care about shortwave anyway. That's just my concern. It's the world not really caring about all of its members, just some, and going forward anyway. WB2GXM. WS2N. VD comment.
VDH and FN recognized. When it comes to transmitting signals over the air, power signal over the air, it's going to be done at some exact frequency. I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 170 kilohertz. Only on that frequency you will hear it. If you're listening at 3.8 megacycles with a reasonable receiver, it's not going to interfere with you. So it's a frequency selective thing. WS2N first, go ahead.
In my car, I still carry a transistor radio around with me. I'll go somewhere, my wife will go in the store, I'll sit in the car, and I'll put this thing on instead of, you know, putting the car itself on. I've been doing this for decades, you know, it's just a habit. It comes from the old days when I used to have problems with the car. I never liked to leave it in the on position just to listen to the radio. I'd have problems with the cars, you know, I just stayed with that. But what Rich is saying is true. You know, I have this radio that worked out here in Rockhock. I used to always listen to 880, which is a CBS radio for the news. And it's getting harder and harder to receive these things. I mean, you know, you ride into a parking lot, and then you have these LED lights in a big parking lot. Certain places, if you park there, you just can't hear anything. And the car itself, if the car is running, you can't hear it. You just have to, when you shut the car off, then it's fine. But even then, you have to turn it just right to pick up the signals. Where years ago, it almost was omnidirectional. So it's getting harder and harder. Back to you, Dick.
I hear you. I think Bob is next. VDH, over to you, K2IW.
Yeah, fine business. This is WA2VDH. Name is John. Yeah, I think the comment that was being discussed there is the potential for general broadband interference if some kind of broadcast power mechanism was achieved. I guess the case in point of comparison is to look at that fiasco that happened several years ago with broadband over power line, and how that generated a general broadband interference. I'm just thinking of the case, if you've ever seen that picture of Tesla sitting there with a Tesla coil arcing all around him. I can imagine that a shortwave radio turned on for receiving anywhere, probably within a couple of miles of that location, would produce nothing but broadband noise, obscuring any possible reception at all. Go ahead.
Can I respond? You're absolutely right. Stand by, Wes. You're absolutely right. The reason why spark gap transmitters were outlawed beyond a certain year is because they were so broadband, they filled up the whole channel. One or two people could only use the channel at once. as opposed to with narrowband techniques, you can get hundreds of thousands of signals into the same number of megacycles of bandwidth. Standby. It turns out that spark gap transmitters are so broad, they make static, and yes, that Tesla coil picture, in reality, that was a time exposure. All of those sparks were not happening at once. That probably was a 5-minute exposure. But yes, he was making a lot of static for miles. This broadband over power line never stood a chance because it was an unshielded system. Didn't have enough bandwidth, had a lot of things that were interfering with it. It would interfere with a whole lot of things. Didn't stand a chance. So after the experiments were run and the grief was discovered, it was essentially outlawed. When it comes to the new Tesla technique of transmitting power, he's going to be probably doing it on some very specific frequency. I picked the number out of the air, 170 kilohertz and megawatts of megavolts of voltage. But it'll be on some particular frequency, and if you're not on that frequency, for the most part, you're not going to be interfered with it. But I am predicting it will not be a successful power transmitting system with reasonable efficiency. Reasonable efficiency means if I put a million watts of power into this system and I'm delivering it to customers, I'd like customers to get 90% of that power. If they got 0.1% of that power, I couldn't stay in business, as opposed to the wired system, if you know what I mean. They're going to discover it's not efficient. And therefore, even if they do it for a while.
Repeater, timeout.
I'm predicting it will only exist as a test signal for a short period of time to confirm its problems, and there's going to be problems. I know Wes believes, from the explanation he was given, there's multiple ways of explaining every radio phenomenon. And because of the particular diagram and method of explanation, it sounds very logical that this inverted wave and the mirror image in the ground and whatever is going to translate your signal directly that you desire from point A to point B. And it's not going to go to point C, D, E, F, G, and so on at the same time. That's hard to believe. N2XJN to defend himself. K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Thank you for giving me the chance. In 2016, the Coen brothers, one is PhD, the other one is just an engineer, they have made the test. There was a big lake, and they were sending approximately 2 milliwatts across that lake. And after that, the billions of hours of investment they've got, and they finished last year the tower in Elm Forest. Don't remember the in Texas. You can Google it, visit, you're going to find it out. His hard work, because it looks like you don't yet quite understand it. Let me jump. In transverse magnetic TM mode, the magnetic field is transverse to the direction of propagation, while the electric field is normal to the direction of propagation. Now, after the near field, that signal doesn't interfere, doesn't make anything, any noise, any interference, nothing. It goes directly to the surface, through the interface that the air lossy medium, and it goes around. The thing is that they already made probably 6 patents how to fight that theft, and what they're doing is they're creating a polyphase. So instead of just one component of the phase, they make a polyphase, and now you have, based on what they say, 23 components too much. And then they foresee this way that you're coming home and you have your refrigerator that could be stopped. Simply stopped because it has ID code, and the code change every 2 seconds. Let me drop.
I'd like to stop you right here, Wes. Goodbye.
But anyhow,
Wes?
Selective way of disconnecting the customers, and they have a selective wave to find if somebody's stealing their energy from the earth. That's how they say. that it works. So it's omnidirectional, but only to the service, and it uses Schumann frequency, which would be one of the harmonics of the Schumann frequency, where the losses are minimum. It's 94-97% efficiency, and you can find it in the internet. That's not only based on Korn Brothers and Tertiate.
Yeah, some of these rotary machines also had greater than unity efficiency. It was a measurement error. And so every electromagnetic wave, transverse electromagnetic wave, real radio wave that has ever been transmitted, all the experiments eventually confirm it is transverse electromagnetic. In other words, the E field and the H field are both at right angles to the propagation. Any method of trying to make the E field in the direction of propagation or the H field in direction of propagation will eventually fail when properly measured. There's always another wave every decade of people. Every decade there's another wave of people who make some measurements where they think they see a non-TEM wave being propagated, and they call it a new kind of radio transmission. And if they don't, then it's not successful. It doesn't get repeated in another laboratory with the same results. So the fact that we found another wave of these people doing it doesn't mean that this time it's going to be successful and all the other times it's not going to be, all the other times it was not successful. It's not going to work. All the evidence to date says all radio waves is TEM. Any method of transmitting a substantial signal through the air has to be a radio wave. I mean, yes, in theory you could make a huge transformer-like device where you transmit a magnetic field between the primary and the secondary, but that's not a practical technique that you can use for multiple miles. Don't go into too many of the fine details with people's names and names of experiments where they think they have done it. That doesn't necessarily prove it, Wes. I can give you, in theory, I could give you a long list of names of people in the Flat Earth Society who will prove to you that the Earth is flat. N2XJN, KQIW, try to keep it brief, Wes.
Repeater, timeout.
Hybrid modes have both electric and magnetic field components in directional propagation. Are you saying those are lossy form of transmission?
In a word, yes. The so-called hybrid mode, could you transmit a signal, a reliable signal, over a 10-mile path at 1 gigahertz using that technique? Yes or no?
How about if you use 20 kilohertz?
At 20 kilohertz, what are you going to use for an antenna?
Every coil that is quarter of wavelength long, it doesn't matter how it's compacted, it resonates. The efficiency is low, but it resonates. And first resonate, and then you can transmit and to exchange.
Okay. In that experiment, you may make it work. Is that now practical? Can you now sell that technique to a million people?
Not. I'm planning on doing the test of the Korn Brothers 100 patent applications, and probably over 30 patents already issued. When it gets a little bit warmer, but I believe strongly that it shouldn't be that billions of dollars now are being given to those two guys just because they try to sell the fake and to share.
Some time ago, Wes, you and quite a number of people believed that there were rotary machines with greater than unity efficiency, and you were a strong believer of that. Do you still believe in greater than unity efficiency of a rotary machine? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
No, but that depends what we're talking about. Every refrigerator has the efficiency over one, and it's normal, but you can do nothing about it. There is no real application. Entrexia.
Now, these were rotary machines where you're going to put 100 watts into it and get 110 watts output. and then by some kind of a feedback mechanism, eventually you wouldn't have to pay Con Edison to run the power of your house. I mean, there were a large number of YouTube videos on people doing that at one time. Sounded good, wasn't real, it was beyond the laws of physics, conservation of energy.
I agree.
Okay, when it comes to hybrid modes of transmission other than TEM, even though people have strong belief, that doesn't mean it's real. KQLIW?
Energy conversion. You can have a river and you put the pipe into the river and that the flow of that water in that pipe is for free. The only energy that you use is just to turn off and turn on the valve. Now, when we're talking about such devices using free energy, which would be the energy that's free of charge, then it's going to work. But it's going to be conversion.
Okay, we've been on this subject for a long time. Only a very small percentage of our listening audience really wants to hear this particular kind of material. We'll have to pick it up again next week, Wes. I'm going to go on to the next person on our list. If he's still awake, we'll soon find out. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Yes, Dick, I'm still here. N2EO. I just wanted to critique the computer I bought from, what do you call, MicroSensor here in Westbury. I've had time to use it and time to play with it. I opened up the right corner, the right panel on the notebook. Not notebook. It's a tower computer. Excuse me for misjudging. Inside, it looks perfectly clean. Everything sparkles. You can tell it's from brand new. Same with the cabinet and everything else. I don't know what they did, but it's a refurbished with a monitor and a keyboard and monitor and a keyboard and mouse, all three, and a computer. It was under $300. Now the only thing I want to say. When I first called MicroSensor, I don't feel I was fairly treated. I told them I have a disability and I can't come into the store. They kept giving me a hard time until one of their people said to me, I'm using disability as a crutch. I got in touch. This was after the sale. I wouldn't have bought it from them after that crack, except a nice fellow that I'd recommend him to anybody. His name is Joe. He's the operations manager in the evening. Anyway, they gave me, I was going to switch over to another company because of that crack. But I stayed with MicroSensor. The fellow Joe gave me a pair of Logitech speakers for my problems. And he is the guy to get in touch with, I feel. If you have a problem, you were achieving. Joe is the operations manager. Also, I told the people in the customer relations what this guy said. And everybody I spoke to said it was unacceptable. And it went back to you, Dick. It's a nice computer. I just had a little problem there. M2EO.
Glad to hear that they eventually treated you more correctly and that there was a empathetic person there on their staff. And my guess is some of the earlier people you talked to were rushed and didn't completely understand what you were saying and so on. the computer that you got, I think you said it was $300, and it sounds like you're pretty happy with it. What's the brand name of that computer? And I think you're saying Micro Center sells it as a refurbished. Was it a one-of-a-kind refurbished, or is that something that they have as a steady product, as a refurbished computer? Rich, N2EO, K2IW.
Yes, Dick, I think it's a regular one. There are various companies, I was told, that the rebuilders. The only other thing, they forgot to give me the activation code. But again, I spoke to this lady. She's very nice, and I can always remember her name. Her name is Patty. I have a Patty living with me. And she contacted Joe. Joe called me up within 15, 20 minutes and gave me an activation code. So they're very, very helpful. You just have to talk to the right people. And as far as disability, there was an old saying during the Korean War. Give them hell, Harry.
A few years ago, there were quite a number of stores selling computer products, and almost all of them have failed, except for Micro Center. So somehow in the big picture, Micro Center is doing something right. They're still there. They're not perfect, but apparently the best we got. I'm glad it's worked out reasonably well for you. Okay, we've gone down the list of people who signed in with questions or comments. We're now going to go over to the space, here we go, science talk. Dr. Roy, AC2GS, has an interesting puzzle tonight, and I didn't cheat. I should have, I know what the puzzle is, but I didn't cheat and look it up, but I've still got a guess as to what I think his astronomy-like puzzle is going to be. AC2GS, K2IW, you got it, Dr. Roy.
Dick, I forgot. You wanted to make a model number.
Go ahead.
Yes, it's a Dell computer. It's a model Optiplex 980. If I looked inside, I couldn't tell it from new. And in a couple of months, basing my opinion of this computer, I'm buying an Apple laptop. Sixth generation. That's the current generation. $300.
That sound like a lot of computer for the money. Okay, Roy, AC2GS, K2RAW.
Thank you, Dick. Hopefully I sound okay.
You do? Your audio is a tiny bit lower than it usually is. Don't worry. It'll probably have a lot less dropouts at this particular volume level. That's a guess on my part. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good. Just want to remind everyone, once again, that if you have any topics, questions, answers, reputations, the email address, as always, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I will be posting links. I already have one link up on my page. I will put up a link by a bunch of electrical engineer blog writers about Texon, Viziv, same company, about this curious technology for anyone to read who's interested. And that's going to be at roy.ac2gs.com. You just type that into your browser and it'll take you to the link page. Let me drop for a second. I just want to point out before I really start the science talk, a couple little things. I believe it was John was worried that wireless cell phone chargers and such were going to erase his cassettes and erase other magnetic medium. My understanding of the present state-of-the-art technology is that there's a certain handshaking required between the wireless power transmitter and receiver that makes sure that it doesn't go to any kind of reasonable power unless there's a a unit that takes the charge. So if you stuck a credit card or a Metro card or something that could be demagnetized on something like a Qi charger, it wouldn't erase it, as far as I'm aware. So sleep well, John. That problem isn't going to happen. Apple and a lot of companies are throwing magnets all over the place, though, so don't throw your magnetized cards all over Apple products. I have this magnetic film that I put over most of the stuff that I buy just so I know where the magnets are hidden. Let me drop. Okay, so for tonight's little puzzle, I offer you a quiet little solar system. Looks can be deceiving. At its core, hydrogen atoms are squeezed together under enormous pressure and enormous heat until all that remains is a helium atom, a solar electron neutrino, and a lot of energy in the form of photons of light. The helium produced by the sun's fusion of hydrogen takes an eternity to get from the core to the sun's surface and out into the sun's solar wind. Millions and millions of years. But light is really faster, right? The trouble is that in the core of our sun, light cannot travel that far behind before it collides with something and gets bounced into another direction. All told, it can take photons anywhere from 10,000 years to 100,000 years to pinball its way out of the core and into the sun's corona. From the sun's corona, those photons require 8-odd minutes to reach our world. What about those neutrinos I mentioned earlier? Well, are they the hare or the tortoise in this little race in the sun's corona? How long do you think it takes the neutrinos to get to the sun's corona? Well, I won't make a guess. It takes approximately 2.3 seconds for those neutrinos to go from the core to the sun's corona. And after it gets there, it's another 8 minutes to reach us here on Earth. So our sun continually produces 380 billion billion megawatts of power. Let me drop for 1 second. It consumes 4 million tons of hydrogen per second. The sun continually converts 564 tons of hydrogen into 560 tons of helium. So where did the other 4 tons go? Well, into almost massless neutrinos and into photons of energy. But despite all of this going on, the energy density released at our sun's core is actually less than the human body releases on a cubic meter by cubic meter basis. We went over this once about 6-7 months ago. So, for tonight's little puzzle, I ask what heavenly body in our own solar system releases the most energy per cubic meter? What do you think, guys?
GXM?
Yes, Rich.
Roy, my first guess is going to be Jupiter, WB2GXM.
Very good. We have one vote for Jupiter. Anyone else with any guesses or ideas on the subject?
K2QAC.
Well, doubled. Was that you, Dick? But I didn't make out the other person.
Yeah, my guess is Venus. I think it was ACD is the other person. Go ahead.
Yes, Bob. I've doubled with you. You want to try that one more time?
My guess, Bob, I'm guessing that it's the Earth with all the human body and animals, etc.
Okay, well, I mean, if the Earth was entirely made up of human beings and you didn't have to worry about the oxygen or the food they had to take in, it certainly would take the sun on a contest. But unfortunately, there's only so much biomass, and there's a lot of mass of rock and iron in the Earth. So I don't think the Earth is a viable contender personally, but does anyone else have any suggestions? So far, we have three planets. So are there any other planets or any other heavenly bodies in our solar system you might want to volunteer? Keep in mind, again, it's not total energy. It's energy per volume. So it's a object whose volume produces more energy for that volume than any other object in our solar system.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'll go with the moon of Io that's going around Jupiter. It has constant volcanic activities. I'll go with that.
AC2LR.
Okay.
AC2LR.
Okay. Kay recognized. What would you like to tell us, Kay?
Just a guess, but since Neptune has so many storms and trying to think of which planet rotates the fastest. Would that be a possibility, Neptune, or whichever is the fastest rotating planet?
It isn't purely just rotational energy that really adds up. With any ideas, any other suggestions before I do my little spiel on this?
D2IS.
Yes, AC2IS.
Since you're phrasing the question, sorry, I came in a little late, so I didn't hear everything, but since you're phrasing the question in terms of, you know, what produces energy, I'm not sure that any of them really produce energy, but aside from the sun, but maybe the moon, because tidal forces act on the moon and kind of cause it to, well, it's tidally locked to the Earth. But maybe that action causes some heat to be dissipated into the moon, and maybe you would count that. Since it's small, maybe that adds up. AC2IS.
Okay, I mean, it's a good thought, and if you follow my logic, it's part of the logic involved with the answer, but let's ask if anyone else has any more ideas. We have, I think, Mercury, Venus, Neptune, and Saturn, I think. I lost track, unfortunately, and the Moon, and Earth.
VDH, I'm also going to vote for Jupiter.
Hey, John,
I'm
down for anyone else.
WA2MHL, Bob here. How about the comet Halley's Comet?
Well, Halley's Comet really doesn't have that much in the way of energy that it's giving off. What happens is it just kind of circles, and it has ice and such, and so when it comes close to the warming of the sun, the ice melts and boils off. You couldn't light probably a cigarette with Halley's Comet, I think.
All right, W is going to make a second guess. The sun.
Okay, that's a good guess. Unfortunately, that's the second highest density power heavenly body. Anyone else?
OIS. As is, I'll take meteor. You know, when the meteors hit the atmosphere and they burn up, or does it have to be in continuous orbit?
I'm thinking of something that doesn't die to kind of give up its energy, but is there today, will be there, you know, 100,000 years from now, and probably still pumping out energy. Mark, you wanted to say something?
After that, I don't know how much energy it has, but I know that Mercury spins the fastest, and it's the only planet that spins in the opposite direction of the rest of them.
Yes, that's quite true, Mark. It spins in the opposite direction, but again, unfortunately, angular momentum is not exactly what I'm looking for, so it's not that planet either. Actually, someone did answer the question correctly. I just kind of like to get other answers because I like to hear different thought processes. So if anyone has any other suggestions or thoughts, let it go, and if not, then I'll move on to giving the person who answered correctly a gold star.
In regards to density, we have only Venus and Mercury. They are too dense. Enter Jean.
Okay, but that answers a different question. That answers the question, what are the densest objects in the solar system? This is what heavenly body produces more heat energy, more energy in general, per cubic meter or kilometer or what have you, per unit volume than any other heavenly body. That's the question, not what the density of the heavenly bodies might be.
C2IS?
Say C2IS.
Yeah, I just wanted to do maybe a little update on my previous answer. I'd say the Earth's moon, because it is tidally, well, not because it's tidally locked to the Earth, but because it produces the tidal forces on the Earth. That energy is coming out of the moon's orbit. So I'm going to say the moon because of the action it has on the Earth. AC2IS.
Okay, very good. So noted. I just want everyone to know that we even got a answer on Echolink, K7WJN, offered the possibility of Mars. So it's nice to see that people on Echolink are participating as well. Does anyone else have any suggestions or comments or want to change their vote, if you will?
C2LR?
Yes, Kay. Okay, whatever, Kay. Unfortunately, your signal was rather noisy, but I got the gist of it. Thanks for participating. Anyone else have any other suggestions, comments, or want to change their vote?
C2OIS, I have a question.
Okay, Mark?
So, someone was talking about the moon controlling the tides on Earth. Well, the question is this. How come there's no tides on the lakes?
Because you need a large volume for the force to work on to produce the rising. Very large lakes do have slight tidal effects. But the average lake is just too small, has too small a surface area, and the amount of force is inconsequential to form a stable wave. That's everyone tells everyone else.
I've got a comment about moon that is opposite of the common sense we've heard up till now.
Okay, Dick, let it go.
Because the moon moves our tides, it's easy to think that the moon is dissipating energy into the water of the Earth. It's actually the other way around. The Earth's rotation is slowly being slowed down by tidal drag. It is coupling that energy into the moon. The moon moves 1.5 inches further away from the Earth each year. The moon is gaining energy from the Earth, not giving up energy from the Earth. Yes, it is moving the tides. That's a secondary effect. So we, the Earth, are coupling energy into the moon, not the other way around. Over to you, Eric. Here we go. Voice, keep your eyes on it.
Yes, indeed, Dick. And once again, the principle, although not the answer, but the principle is kind of important in the ultimate answer of what per unit volume heavenly body is generating, is giving off more energy than any other part in the solar system. So, and someone already answered it, but, you know, like I said, if you want to talk amongst yourselves, if you want to change your vote, if you have anything else to bring up on the subject, feel free before I ruin it by telling you guys all about it. Okay, I guess I milked this for all it's worth. Well, the gold star tonight goes to Paul. Jupiter's moon Io has more than 400 geysers spewing superheated liquid sulfur dioxide that normally rests just below its surface. Every year, Io pumps about 10,000 million tons of matter into space. It falls back in the moon's low gravity and coats Io in sulfur. It isn't nuclear fusion that's driving all this energy, but pure gravitational forces at work. Io is the innermost moon of Jupiter's Galilean moon. It orbits Jupiter at the same distance that our moon orbits our planet, but Jupiter is 318 times as massive as the Earth. And Io orbits Jupiter not at our leisurely pace of our moon of 27-odd days, but at a sprightly 1.7 days. It isn't only Jupiter's gravitational forces energizing Io. It's Io's fellow Galilean moons, Europa and Ganymede. Ganymede is actually the largest of Jupiter's and the largest moon in the entire solar system. It is larger than the planet closest to our sun, good old Mercury. For every four orbits Io makes around Jupiter, Europa completes two and Ganymede completes orbits. Because of this, periodically, Europa and Ganymede line up, reinforcing each other's gravitational tug on Io, elongating Io's own orbit around Jupiter. And all of this hugging between Jupiter on one side and Europa and Ganymede on the other squeezes Io to its core and heats that core up quite a bit. So the answer is, Io is the most energetic heavenly body per given volume. On this before I move on to my next little item.
VDH with a comment.
RIW with a comment about Jupiter.
Hey, John first, then Dick.
Oh, yeah, my question is, in terms of Io, how close would it have to be to the point where tidal forces would actually break up Io and cause another set of rings? Is it anywhere near that point of happening? Go ahead.
Unfortunately, I can't tell you the tip-over point, but obviously I don't think, and I don't think anyone does think, that that's a serious risk in the short term. I actually have a little story to tell you about the rings of Saturn later on tonight, which might add to this little Michigan. I don't think it's anywhere close enough to cause that kind of disruption. It's a rather large moon. It takes a lot of force to smash it to pieces. Dick, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, whether or not a moon going around a planet is adding energy to the planet or the planet is adding energy to the moon is primarily a function of which rotates fastest. In the case of our moon going around the Earth once every 28 days, roughly, and our Earth rotates once every 24 hours, one day, we're rotating faster. Therefore, we couple energy, like gravity hydrodynamics, so to speak, into the moon. That's why the moon is moving out an inch and a half per year. In the case of Jupiter, that's also true. Jupiter rotates once every 9.5 hours. The planet rotates that fast. But Io goes around something like 1.5 days. So Io is not spiraling into the moon, into Jupiter. It is spiraling out away from Jupiter. And there's a mechanism there by which Jupiter can couple energy into Io. And probably some of that is by way of the huge radiation that comes out of, there's a strong radiation field coming out of Jupiter, and those fields, magnetic among other kinds, sweeping through Io, is one of the mechanisms by which I think Jupiter is coupling energy into Io and heating it up. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Well, Dick, I'm sure nothing is a pure system, that it's not purely gravitational, but there are a lot of gravitational forces. As I mentioned, not only do you have the gravitational force of Jupiter acting upon Io, but you have the two other slightly more outer Galilean moons of Europa and Ganymede, and every so often they line up and cause tidal forces on the other side. They squeeze Io one way, they squeeze Io the other way. They distort its orbit as well, and so there's a lot of gravitational energy going into it. Now, there might be some other radiation coming from Jupiter, but I get the sense in what I read that a lot of it is primarily gravitational in origin.
WS2N.
Cool.
Yes, that's what I've understood. It's all gravitational forces between the moons and Jupiter itself. And it's also the heat that's created. They always described it as taking a paper clip and bending it back and forth. You can start to feel it heat up. Well, that's what happens. Because it has a constant resonance with Io, it's constantly getting, you know, the same effect as heating the inside of the moon. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, the gravitational forces are causing mechanical forces, and the stress and the strain and the pulling back and the force and is increasing the average kinetic energy, otherwise known by all of us as the temperature. And so it blows up geysers, 400 geysers, not really volcanoes per se, but much more characteristic of geysers that we know, except this one is pouring out liquid sulfur dioxide at an incredible rate. It's probably not a great tourist attraction, but that's my understanding, at least, of the joys of Io.
I can tell that NASA is not going to send a landing spacecraft onto Io. KQLIW.
No, I think they're first going to try and land something on the sun before they go that far.
By way of the Parker space satellite, they're coming as close to the sun's surface as you can possibly get without melting down all your hardware.
Yes, indeed, and I'm really looking forward to see if they figure out exactly if they can explain the temperature differential between the surface and the corona.
There are a number of space report articles in the last week on just that, but they think they've got a better and better explanation for where the huge temperatures, like a million degrees, is the corona of the sun, and how come the majority of what we see is the surface, only at 5,500 degrees, and that's because although the corona is very hot, it is transparent material at most of those wavelengths, so therefore it's not radiating quite as fast as this temperature would indicate, but that corona is a ionized conductive material, electronically conductive material, so all of those magnetic fields on the sun from all those sunspots are sweeping through the conducting material of the corona, and those, by Faraday's law, you're creating all kinds of fancy currents flowing through various channels in the corona, and that's the heating mechanism. I think they've somewhat settled on that. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Well, I've heard them talk about wave phenomena, almost like sonic booms going off on the surface. I particularly like the magnetic constriction theory. That's very, very close to what you were just describing now, that incredible magnetic forces on the surface of the sun and randomly going this way and that, constricting the plasma flow. And, you know, when you constrict plasma, the temperatures go sky high. So that's my pet theory, but we'll see what happens. I'm sure scientists love to quibble over data, so I doubt that people have put a bow in it yet. But it'll be kind of interesting to see if they do after all the results from Parker come back. On to the next. You know, guys, I like to offer YouTube videos, and I found interesting this past week. Tonight, I offer you a link on roy.ac2gs.com to a very nice YouTube from a fellow that returned from an ultrasound imaging of his wife's maturing fetus. Many people have watched others have ultrasound imaging performed or had it done on themselves. The first thing that you usually notice is that the ultrasound technician smears some gelatinous material over the skin that the ultrasound probe will be placed over. And this particular fellow in this YouTube video wondered why. So what followed was, to me, a very entertaining and informative discussion regarding how waves propagate through different media at different velocities with different impedances, causing a partial reflection of waves. He demonstrates this quite beautifully using a demonstration device made out of a row of sticks of wood strung together with a long rubber band, and he uses little small nuts as counterweights on the end of these wooden sticks to mimic impedance mismatches. So the ultrasound gel acts as an acoustic medium matching substance and limits the wasteful reflection of the diagnostic ultrasound at the surface of the body. Let me drop for a sec. It allows most of the ultrasonic energy to propagate into the body and be available to show internal structures like a healthy growing fetus. Now, hams are always talking about standing wave ratios and impedance matching circuits and antenna tuners, and this struck me as an excellent analogy in the acoustic world of the same exact phenomena. So whenever there is an impedance mismatch, there is an abrupt change in the wave propagation speed, and every time that happens, there's a partial reflection of those waves at these interfaces. It happens with ultrasound, it happens with light traveling through plate glass, and we see a reflection on the glass's surface. And unfortunately, it happens when our transmission line reaches an impedance mismatch. So I thought you might like to see this YouTube video, and as I said, I've put a link to it right at roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
An unrelated query, AC2IS.
Yeah, sure, AC2IS.
I've heard for many years the prediction of the end of Moore's Law, and recently, for the past couple of years, I guess the predictions, quote-unquote, have changed to Moore's Law has already come to an end. I was wondering if anyone had any information on or detail on why that was the case. I know that, you know, what Moore's Law is, it relates to the, you know, basically being able to pack in twice as many transistors into the same area about every 2 years. But does anybody know how small transistors have gotten, how small they might yet get, and why we think Moore's Law has ended? AC Joyous.
Okay, very good. I'll open it for conversation. Let me throw in my two cents worth. Moore's Law has always been a more of an anecdotal thing than a theory of the universe. It just so happens that seems to have been the rate of improvement in the technology over a short period of time. But the problem is that as you get smaller and smaller solid-state devices, the little micro-transistors in integrated circuits, you get a narrower and narrower channel. I think the narrowest, the smallest diameter for an element in an integrated circuit is around 7 nanometers. As you get smaller and smaller, you get a lot of problems with leakage and electron tunneling and quantum level effects. Not to mention, it's very difficult to design such small pieces of equipment using things like ultraviolet photolithography. They played all kinds of cute little tricks technologically of how to get the mask to a small size of 7 nanometers. So we're getting to a point where the laws of quantum mechanics are going to get in the way, and we're going to have to hopefully redesign how solid-state integrated circuits work if we want to increase the density. That's probably going to take time, if it's even possible. You have technologies like spintronics and other somewhat esoteric fields of physics that work at quantum level